We've always said that this series is about so much more than just this election. As we've shown in our first four episodes, the voting issues of our past and how our country responds to them paved the way forward, shaping future elections, including the history-making moment we're living in today. But now, here we are, just days away from the 2020 presidential election. And I don't know about you, but I have severe acid indigestion. So before getting into our main interview today, I wanted to dive into some of this week's big election stories. So the good news, particularly for a show called Turnout, is that people are turning out to vote in droves. By this recording, Americans have cast over 71 million early ballots, which is more than half of all ballots cast in the 2016 election. People are mailing them in, voting early, making a plan for election day. It's so inspiring. I, for one, called a lot of my friends to make sure they were getting their asses to the polls. I'm calling to see if you voted or you have a voting plan, Catherine.
Yes, I have voted. I did a mail-in ballot.
Calling to see if you voted.
Of course I voted.
I've already submitted my mail-in ballot.
Excellent.
I voted yesterday.
Good.
I have a plan to vote. I have both an absentee ballot at home.
But the rules about how and when those votes will be counted are the subject of a political tug of war in some key states. States like Wisconsin, where the Supreme Court had to step in with a decision on October 26.
In another major blow to Democrats,
Wisconsin can't count mailed-in ballots received after Election Day.
If it's not close in Wisconsin, it doesn't matter. If it comes down, like it did last time, to tens of thousands of votes, this could very easily make up the difference between who ends up winning this election.
The Wisconsin ruling is just the latest in a flurry of election year decisions that, rather than grant leeway because of the pandemic, as Democrats argue, have mostly sided with Republicans, keeping voting restrictions in place.
The Texas Supreme Court just issued a ruling essentially shutting the door on allowing all Texans to vote by mail during the coronavirus pandemic.
And the U.S. Supreme Court blocked a lower court from allowing curbside voting in Alabama.
Another change in the witness signature debate for South Carolina absentee ballots. There's been so much back and forth. Finally, the Supreme Court ruled that those signatures are required.
And there are more cases like these that could be affected by Judge Amy Coney Barrett's swift dissent to the highest court in the land.
This was a rigorous confirmation process, and I thank all of you, especially Leader McConnell and Chairman Graham, for helping me to navigate it. It's a privilege to be asked to serve my country in this office, and I stand here tonight truly honored and humbled.
While it's true that this political tug of war has always happened as each party vies for power every election, this year is different.
Mail-in voting has surged this year as Americans seek to avoid crowds at polling places, even as Trump repeatedly claimed without evidence that it leads to voter fraud.
Because the President of the United States has taken fears of voter fraud to a new level, a level that questions the integrity of the entire election process.
This is going to be a fraud like you've never seen. Thousands of votes are gathered and they come in and they're dumped in a location, and then all of a sudden you lose elections that you think you're going to win. You know, so many years I've been watching elections, and they say the projected winner or the winner of the election. I don't want to see that take place in a week after November 3rd or a month or, frankly, with litigation and everything else that can happen, years, or you never even know who won the election.
I'm Katie Couric, and this is Turnout.
Can you or the White House staff or your campaign provide any evidence to back up your claim that mail-in voting is rife with fraud, like the example you gave of people working in rooms filling out false ballots? And where's the evidence?
I think there's a lot of evidence, but we'll provide you with some, okay? And there's evidence that's being compiled.
Today on the podcast, an interview with an unlikely critic of President Trump.
The president's rhetoric, unproven rhetoric, the fact that there is not sufficient evidence to show systemic fraud did flip a switch, because that's where the irresponsibility comes in.
Benjamin Ginsburg is a top Republican election lawyer who just retired in August after 38 years in the GOP trenches. Now he's spending his time writing op-eds, and one that got my attention back in September was a surprisingly blunt rebuke of the president's baseless claims that the electoral system is rigged.
The sanctity of elections and making sure they're done properly should be of deep concern to everyone. It really is the foundation of the democracy. And for the 40 years that I'd been working in Republican politics, I was either in a precinct or part of a sort of a roving lawyer team in a state or running a nationwide program where we were talking to people in polling places to see what the problems were. Republicans, I mean, probably back since the days of Tammany Hall and the big city machines, have been suspicious of fraudulent elections and vote rigging. So we've always looked for it. And every state law has provisions for poll watchers or election observers. And both parties should take full advantage of that because it's very important to have your people in a polling place to look for problems. And so we've done that. Now, there were sort of sporadic instances of fraud that came to light, but never, nothing that would justify a president of the United States, really any candidate, saying our elections are fraudulent and they're rigged, and the only way I can lose is if they cheat, because there simply is not evidence to support that. And so to say otherwise is completely destructive. So I think that this is brought us into new and dangerous territory. And the fact that I had been a part of those programs for so many years meant that I thought I had a perspective on it.
And what concerns you the most about the rhetoric we're hearing undermining our electoral process from the president of the United States himself?
Well, you see it reflected in the polls this cycle where a dangerously and shockingly high number of people say they're not sure that the election's going to be valid and the results accurate. And that's really a product of presidential rhetoric and certainly not a product of any real evidence.
Well, let me ask you this. To play devil's advocate, we've never had an election quite like this, obviously, Ben, in the midst of a pandemic with a really unprecedented number of mail-in ballots. And I'm curious if you think that that might provide fertile ground for the kind of election fraud that some people in the specifically in the Republican Party are warning us of.
Well, first of all, I think there are two sides to the coin, and we should talk about that. So there is a huge difference between a rhetorical fusillade that elections are fraudulent or rigged and actually being able to show that in a way that would taint the results of an election. And rather than talking at a rally or making threats in a tweet, you will really have to go precinct by precinct and find specific instances of fraud. They can find specific instances of fraud. It should be rooted out and corrected. But to be able to actually throw the results of the election in doubt, there will have to be ballots that are called into question. Now, I don't believe that there will be a specific number of individual ballots that can be called into question. And mass challenges have always been frowned upon in as a matter of law and in legal proceedings. So I think that feelings have been revved up to a much higher degree in this election. But I think the results and the casting and counting of ballots themselves will be done in a way that there will be verifiable results of the election.
How can you assure listeners of that, that the systems are in fact in place that will prevent and penalize any kind of voter fraud, even if it is in fact very sporadic?
Well, I think it's true on a number of levels. First of all, is that you can go back and look at instances of fraud that have been uncovered and prosecuted. Rarely is it enough to overturn the results of an election, but sometimes. There was a congressional race in North Carolina in 2018 where there were illegalities found, so a new election was held. There have been elections in Paterson, New Jersey in this past year where there was found to be systemic fraud, and that was corrected. But at the end of the day, I think people can take a degree of certitude knowing that their ballots are going to be counted in their community by their neighbors. The U.S. system has over 10,500 jurisdictions with some degree of authority for the casting and counting of ballots. In a normal year, over 1 million people will volunteer to be poll watchers. They're all people from your communities. And I was co-chair of a presidential commission, bipartisan commission, back in 2013 and 14, where we got to spend an extraordinary amount of time meeting the actual people from the communities on the state, county, and local levels who are responsible for conducting elections. And I take a great amount of solitude in knowing how good those people are and how much they do care.
Having said that, what was your reaction, Ben, when you started hearing Donald Trump, President Donald Trump, and other high-ranking Republicans start laying the groundwork for an all-out assault on our democratic process?
Well, I'm not sure that they laid the groundwork for an all-out assault. I think they used irresponsible and regrettable rhetoric. But again, the groundwork for an assault would require challenging on a local level in a very granular fashion. And the battleground states, with the exception of Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan, have all begun to process their absentee ballots already, the mail-in votes that we've been reading are coming in such heavy quantity. And there have not been those wide-scale challenges. So at least so far, that's been more rhetoric than reality.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back after this short break. Let's return to my interview with Republican election lawyer Ben Ginsburg. Let's talk about these legal battles. The RNC and the Trump re-election campaign, as you know, have doubled their legal budget to $20 million. I think you called it a torrent of 2020 voting litigation already underway. What up with that, Ben?
Well, so it's an interesting phenomenon, and I think you need to take a step back to appreciate it. In 2010, Republicans did very well in the Obama midterms and took control of a number of state legislatures and won a number of governorships, and then increased that in 2012 on the state and local level. That gave Republicans the ability to pass legislation that they felt gave them an advantage in the electoral context. And so they did pass any number of laws. The Clinton forces, and really much more the Biden forces, decided that they would go to court to try and turn back those pieces of legislation that Republicans passed. Now, before we start clicking our tongues at the bad Republicans for doing that, recognize that when Democrats won control of the Nevada legislature and governorship, and the New Jersey legislature and governorship, they have now, since 2018, passed the Democratic version of legislation that helps them in elections. So it's something that both parties do. The RNC sued the Democrats after they passed that legislation. The Republicans have been more successful in this past decade in winning legislatures. And so they have passed any number of laws that the Democrats don't like. And the Democrats have gone to court, both federal and state, to try and redress it. Now that the shoe is a little bit on the other foot after the 2018 elections, Democrats have passed their bills and Republicans have gone to court. So the weight of the legislation is really because Republicans did better in elections earlier in the decade.
Well, this seems pretty effed up to me, Ben. I mean, why are these election laws so malleable depending on who's in power? Can't they? I mean, I guess that's our system of government, but it seems a little screwed up to me.
Well, I think that they are policy choices that get made in legislation. It happens in laws involving elections. It certainly happens in laws involving taxes or the environment or any other issue that you want to choose. There are differences between the parties, and when one party gets in power, they have a tendency to want to pass their agenda.
I get that, but voting should be sacrosanct, don't you think?
Well, I think that there are disagreements in policy over elections. Republicans tend to fear fraud, and Democrats tend to fear suppression. And one of the other underlying phenomenons that's grown in the country over the last 30 years is polarization, so that there are very few undecided voters at this point in an election. That means that each parties go to their base to try and energize their bases to come out. And so the rhetoric and the foundational work that gets done reflects that. And that is what I think you're saying is bad. And, that's a much bigger phenomenon than just elections and voting.
Do you believe that concern about voter fraud can inevitably lead to voter suppression?
Well, I think that they are in some ways two sides of the same coin. And I think that not all the laws that are accused of being suppression are suppression. And as I've written, I think many of the charges about fraud are wrong. But I think, unfortunately, the fraud versus suppression narrative has creeped into the get out the vote plans of both parties. And as you try and energize your base with red meat rhetoric, which is what we do these days on both sides, Republicans are going to yell fraud, Democrats are going to yell suppression. That probably does energize their base. But what I think you're rightly pointing to is, what about people in the middle of the spectrum who are not hard partisans, who really kind of want to weigh the candidates and the issues and vote one way or the other? They hear the loud decibels about fraud and suppression and think, wow, that's a hassle for me to go to the polls, so I'm not going to go to the polls.
Can you give me an example of a Republican law, state law, or passed by a Republican-controlled legislature regarding voting, and one that might have been passed by a Democratic legislature?
Let's take a look at the date in which absentee ballots need to be received by a state. So at least the cases that are going up to the Supreme Court are ones where Republicans voted to have all absentee ballots received in the polling place on Election Day. The Democrats have been convinced that it is better, really, for them to get more votes in, to be able to extend the deadlines on the receipt of absentee ballots. So any ballot postmarked by Election Day can be received 3 days, 6 days, 12 days after an election. So a Republican legislature would pass Election Day receipt, and a Democratic legislature has passed some days afterwards.
If there is so little fraud, why is the Republican Party passing all these laws preventing fraud if experience tells us that there is very little fraud.
So the credibility of our elections also depends on their appearance. In other words, can voters take confidence that it's a system with some standards so that cheating and fraud don't go on? In other words, the appearance of impropriety is recognized, for example, in campaign finance laws, which I'm sure you love, to justify limitations on the size of contributions. There hasn't been a finding of impropriety. It's an appearance of impropriety. The same holds true in the election contest, that you do need to put some standards on it, whether it's showing voter identification when you go into the polls or a signature match on an absentee ballot, to give voters after the election some elements of proof that, in fact, all the votes are legitimate.
You outright ask Republicans to, quote, take a hard look before advocating laws that actually do limit the franchise of otherwise qualified voters.
Yeah. I think that's important for Republicans to do. I think that's not always enough of the equation in all these states. I think it is important to make it easy for people to vote. To give you an example, Republicans have all of a sudden gone negative on drop boxes, where voters can take their ballots and drop them in a box, and that's the way it gets they get processed and counted. So they don't have to stand in lines either in early voting. They don't have to trust the mails by mailing them through the postal service, the drop box. Republicans, for some reason, have decided that drop boxes are a bad idea. That, to me, is a barrier to voters that makes little or no sense. And I don't think it's right that the Republican Party in a number of states has taken that position.
When we come back, Ben Ginsburg throws water on the president's fiery claims and the Democrats' worst post-election fears. Why do you think President Trump is saying fraud, 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 fraud whenever he gets a chance?
No, I don't know. I'm a humble lawyer and not a psychiatrist, so I'm not sure I really know the answer to that question.
Come on, Ben. You know the answer.
I don't. Why? Tell me the answer.
I think because he wants to be able to delegitimize the election if he doesn't win.
Play that out for me, Katie. What? Play that out for me. How does that happen?
So, I don't know. I mean, I think he says...
I don't know either, I'm not sure
anybody...
Well,
here, wait a second. But let's say, what if he says, Ben, let's just play this out, like you said. What if he says that there's voter fraud, it's everywhere, and some of these Republican legislatures, you know, agree with him, or people who he has in his pocket agree with him, and then he can hold the entire country hostage... By saying this isn't legitimate.
That's honestly not the way it works. That's why I said before that there's a massive difference between talking about fraud and trying to delegitimize an election and having the proof of that in a state election process. And that's why I think the notion that he's somehow going to disrupt the whole country is a little bit overblown. Because like you, no one can exactly say the steps that it would take to get from, oh, gee, everything's fraudulent, to actually stopping the certification of a vote and the naming of a slate of electors in any state.
So it's a case of all talk. But if you did have to hypothesize, Ben, how someone might try to go about delegitimizing the election results. How might one do that if one was so inclined?
Well, I think the hypothetical that I did discuss in one of those Washington Post op-eds was that the campaign, the Trump campaign, would quite cynically engage in mass challenges of voters as they went into polling places on grounds of registration. And then in the counting of ballots, on the validity of absentees as they came in. But it would have to be massive blunderbuss challenges. So if the polls are to be believed, in the key battleground states, there are not enough challenges. Now, if the results are considerably closer, right, and this does hinge on the results in any of the battleground states being really close, then it might be possible to challenge enough ballots to hold up a certificate of election so that the Electoral College would get a little bit murky.
Well, what would happen if it's close enough that you could challenge the results in these key battleground states? Take me through that. Then what would
depends.
Happen?
Well, I mean, it depends on the state. So, there are so many variables and different pieces that would have to fall into place that you'd be tempted to say it's impossible, except Florida happened in 2000, so not impossible. But it's really highly unlikely. What would have to happen is that, I guess, the Electoral College, nobody would have 270 votes when all the states that could tabulate their ballots did. And there would be one, two, or three states that were within the margins of closeness set by state law, which is either 0.2% or 0.5% of the difference between the two candidates. And so there would be a recount or a contest. And, you know, when they're that close, there are always ballots that can be disputed. But that's also part of the legitimate process, if an election is close, to go through a recount or a contest.
Do you think we might get to the point where the Supreme Court decides who the next president of the United States is this go round?
Well, I mean, I think it's really, really unlikely. You know, I think the greatest chance is that we'll have a pretty clear indication of a winner, if not election night, within a couple of days of that. I think given all the absentees that have been filed, it may take a week or two longer. I think the election has been so close and contested that it's been thrown in doubt three times out of the 57 that we've had. So I'm going to take a wild guess that there's a 5.2% chance of it being that. And so in that scenario, it might end up going to the Supreme Court. But that hasn't happened often in our history. And it's a mistake to bet against history.
Let's talk about 2000, because you were imminently involved in the recount in Florida. Bob Balaban played you in the movie Recount. Did you like that casting, by the way, Ben?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Somebody must have thought I was short and bald.
Are we going to win, Mr. Ginsburg?
By tomorrow morning, the stains of Bill Clinton will be washed away. And honor and dignity will finally be restored to the White House.
Let me just point out about the casting that I thought Bob Balaban was terrific. But Michael Hooley, who was my opposite on the Democratic side, is both shorter and balder than I am. And he was played by Dennis O'Leary, a 6'2" inch guy with a full head of hair. So I'm just going to throw that out as a casting example of the film.
Duly noted. But how insane was it for you? By the way, it made me want to rewatch Recount tonight, because I was covering that every day when I was at the Today Show. I mean, was that completely insane?
Yes, it certainly was. Just remember when you rewatch it that we won the recount and they won the movie.
Well, I guess it depends on who you're rooting for president, right?
Well, I'm just saying that's a statement of fact.
But, you know, I mean, it does show us something about the system with this whole difference between the popular vote and the Electoral College. Does it ever make you wonder if the system needs to be rethought and the Electoral College perhaps gotten rid of?
Well, I mean, that's an interesting point. I mean, the historical antecedents of the Electoral College is that the founding fathers needed a compromise between the agrarian interests and the Federalists, who were more in the cities. And so the Electoral College was the compromise that we've had for 240-some years. It's a compromise that's worked in the sense that campaigning for president would be completely different. And what would happen is that candidates would go to urban areas and forget rural areas because there just aren't enough votes. So that would be a shift and really an isolation of the country as a whole. I mean, I think that changing the Electoral College and talk of that is something that comes about when Democrats don't win a series of presidential elections they think they should. My guess is if Joe Biden is elected, all the talk of the Electoral College will retreat to fashionable cocktail parties on the west side of Manhattan and maybe the east side. But I mean, it's changing the Electoral College. Those are the rules under which we play the game. It's the equivalent of a football team that gains a lot of yards but can't score, saying, forget it. Don't worry about what's on the scoreboard. We're not counting that anymore. The team that gains the most yards is going to win. So you can change the rules if you really want to, but changes that are done to sort of preordain an outcome, which is what this bout of wanting to change the Electoral College is about, doing that to gain a specific political result, it's a bad, bad reason to change an institution that's been around for 240 years.
On the other hand, Ben, if 85% of people in this country by 2045 are living in cities and far outweigh the number of people in rural areas, maybe an adjustment could be made.
Well, maybe if that's the way the demographic patterns really go, then I think that's possible. Look, I also think that part of the angst that's felt about the Electoral College has really nothing to do with politics, or is not a product of politics, but a product of a 40-year demographic trend in this country for people to move into communities with people more like themselves. We are living in much more homogeneous communities than we ever did before. And so a lot of the polarization that has occurred, which is really what you're talking about is the root problem with the Electoral College, has been caused by these sort of inexorable demographic trends. You know, I'm not sure changing the Electoral College deals with that root issue.
Let's talk about your role specifically in 2000. How would you describe it? What were you there to do?
Well, I was the general counsel of the Bush-Cheney campaign. And I had, because I had worked elections and for the political party committees, done a lot of recounts on the congressional and state level. And so when we got ourselves in a recount, I had helped prepare a lot of the basic materials that you always do for recounts. And then I went down to Florida to help run the operations.
What is your perspective on the impact that event had on our election system?
The most immediate impact was that in 2003, Congress actually passed a massive infusion of money into the election systems. Almost all communities bought new machines, new technology at that point. And so it really, for a period of time, upgraded the mechanics of voting in the country. I mean, the problem is that those machines don't have a huge long shelf life. And most jurisdictions in the country now are running pretty long in the tooth on the equipment that they're using.
Not only that, Ben, but they can be hacked and they can't be often. I don't know. I did a documentary called I Voted, and it showed how easy it was to hack some of those systems. Some University of Michigan students did it in a couple of days. Furthermore, there's no way to verify and double check some of the results. So electronic voting is kind of problematic, don't you think?
Well, I do have a problem with the touchscreen machines,
right?
In which there's no paper trail. Yeah, I certainly agree with that. I think it's a real mistake. And we're in a bad way with our voting systems. I mean, it's really tough to get communities who have to build schools and roads and feed people to appropriate money for elections equipment that's used every other year, maybe twice. It's just not a top priority of the state and local governments that actually do the funding for machines. So that's a problematic issue. And plus, most of the technology was put in place before there were iPads. So there are generations of improvements that could take place that really are not a top priority in state and local government funding.
We started the conversation, Ben, you saying that we're protected against voter fraud. It happens very rarely. The Republican battle cry is fraud. The Democratic battle cry is suppression. So where do we stand in this kind of, you know, yin-yang world of one side focusing on one thing and the other side focusing on another?
Well, I think it's not ideal. I think it's a function or a symptom of the polarization that's part of the electorate and part of society. And those are messages to the base voters and not to the people in the middle who are not fierce partisans. So that's not a way that you're going to expand the electorate at all.
How do you restore faith in democracy in your view?
That is a complicated question in this day and age. I mean, I suppose it ultimately goes to the quality of our leaders on a national level. And I think it also goes to the way we act in our local communities. In other words, the way I think you achieve the goal of restoring faith in the system is to be able to change the terms of the debate away from really polarized rhetoric and actions. I would be curious about other views on this, but I think that is more likely to occur on a local level, where it strikes me that people working with their neighbors are more likely to come up with solutions to problems than folks on the national level who are retreating to their sort of polarized bunkers.
And finally, do you have faith in our election process? Do you feel like it will withstand any potential challenges from the president to others if the election doesn't go their way?
Well, I mean, I ultimately do. I think it can be a difficult period post-election if it's close, to be sure. But I do take faith in having known so many of the officials on a local level and a state level who actually are the election system in this country. And while when you have 10,500 jurisdictions and a million volunteers, there will be mistakes. But I certainly do have faith in their good intents to get this done in a really professional and good way. And I suppose it's also important to remember, every state's law does have proceedings to allow for recounts and contests, especially when the results are close. And every candidate, whether you like them or not, has the right
or
to
like
take
her
advantage
or not.
Or like her or not, because I was going to get to that. Remember that Hillary Clinton's campaign intervened in Jill Stein's recounts in three states, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin last year, at the end of November, so that contesting elections is permitted by state law. Is one of those things candidates are allowed to do. Hillary Clinton did it. Stacey Abrams has not yet conceded the Georgia governor's race. Never conceded. So that when implicit in your question is that Donald Trump won't concede, that's been done before too. And, you know, the system moves on.
You know, after talking with Ben, I was inspired to rewatch Recount, which I'm actually in for a nanosecond. And I have to say, given the times we're in, it was pretty weird. There was actually one moment that stood out that I had to share.
Johnny Apple says that we have a week to resolve this before the American people will lose their patience.
In this scene, Al Gore's team is debating how to conduct the recount, whether they should go into Democratic-friendly counties and hand count the paper ballots. And Warren Christopher, who was the Democratic face of the recount and a former Secretary of State, played in the movie by John Hurt, says they need to be careful about how they proceed because...
The world is watching. We are, theoretically, its last great democracy. If we cannot resolve this in a way that is worthy of the office we seek, what kind of hope do we give other countries who wish to share our values?
We all know how that turned out, but an important reminder come Tuesday. Okay, everyone, my final plea. Do make a plan. Whether you're dropping your mail-in ballot off at an official location, make sure it's not past the deadline in your state to actually put it in the mail, voting early in person, or heading to the polls on November 3rd. Bring a sandwich or the snack of your choice. Listen to a podcast. And if you have any lingering questions, go to vote.org for voting details specific to your state. For election coverage and interesting and fun non-political items too, sign up for my morning newsletter, Wake Up Call, by going to katiecouric.com. Oh, and one last thing, some advice to calm those election night nerves from our friend Jesse Littlewood at Common Cause.
It's important to remember that election night is not results night. It's when we count every vote that we decide the results of the election. We would all like to know the results of the election as soon as possible, and we should strive to do that, but it's more important to be accurate than it is to be fast.
Okay, listeners, good luck out there. I'll see you next week on the other side. Turnout is a production of iHeartMedia and Katie Couric Media. The executive producers are Katie Couric and Courtney Litz. Supervising producer is Lauren Hansen. Associate producers, Derek Clements, Eliza Costas, and Emily Pinto. Editing by Derek Clements and Lauren Hansen. Mixing by Derek Clements. Our researcher is Gabriel Luzer. And special thanks to my right-hand woman, Adriana Fazio. You can follow me in all my election coverage at Katie Couric. Meanwhile, yes, I'm Katie Couric. Thanks so much for listening, everyone. We'll see you next time.